Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, this Tuesday, July 14th, 2026, for our Commodities and Energy edition.
Our central thesis today focuses on the widening fracture between historical macroeconomic stability and the new reality of structural volatility. We are seeing a fundamental decoupling of credit markets from the longstanding assumptions of a low inflation, predictable growth regime.
Essentially, the old rules of global liquidity are being rewritten in real time.
The data tells a story that instability is manifesting through significant shifts across global credit markets and broader macroeconomic landscapes.
The high-yield index is currently sitting at $68 billion, yet the distressed ratio hasn't broken 11% in over 6 years. It's a market that is simultaneously teetering on the edge of a cliff and acting like it's on a spa retreat. Today, we're digging into the plumbing of global credit markets, the hidden leverage in AI, and why the energy sector is the ultimate lightning rod for this entire mess.
It's a strange paradox, Maya. You have this sense of stability on the surface, but if you look at the loan market specifically, the extreme distress, we're talking loans yielding over 20%, is being much more effectively hidden than it is in the bond market.
It's the classic everything is fine until the insurance company realizes the house is actually made of flammable cardboard. It's the kind of market instability that leads to sudden margin calls, frantic middle-of-the-night liquidations, and eventually, a very expensive way to learn that stable was just a typo for stagnant.
Well, the stagnation might be about to break, but not necessarily in a good way. Phil Brendel of C Street warns that we are entering a historically difficult window between August and November 2026. He's looking at persistent high interest rates and a bruising consumer environment creating massive refinancing hurdles, particularly for the technology and communications sectors.
And I assume technology and communications is code for the companies that everyone assumed were invincible.
Something to flag here, we're seeing a massive shift in how these companies are funded. As McElreath from Exponents pointed out, we're seeing AI hyperscalers move from debt-light, cash-heavy profiles to highly leveraged structures without any commensurate revenue growth. This effectively turns what looks like high-quality AA credit into much riskier A or BBB debt. It's the 1990s telecom boom all over again, where massive debt issuance was predicated on a technological promise that hasn't yet materialized in the cash flows.
So we're basically just buying the hype with borrowed money and hoping the AI doesn't become obsolete before the interest payments are due.
It's even more structural than that. Look at the capital structure of Optimum Communications. They utilized a strategic asset shifting mechanism, moving $2.3 billion in EBITDA from restricted to unrestricted subsidiaries. That effectively stripped the value away from the guarantees held by the lenders in the restricted group. It's a way to hollow out the protections that credit investors rely on.
That's not a refinancing challenge, that's a disappearing act.
It is.
And it's compounded by the fact that the refinancing premium, the gap between what a company pays on old bonds and what they'd pay on new ones, is evaporating. We are approaching a point where it might actually become a refinancing discount, which creates a massive incentive for issuers to flood the market with new supply right now to lock in whatever they can.
Which sounds like a great way to trigger a supply glut that no one can absorb.
Which is exactly why some investors are retreating to esoteric assets. Instead of fighting over the crowded liquid indices, they are looking at index-like but not index-eligible strategies. They're moving into things like equipment finance or shipping containers, essentially searching for yield in the off-the-run sectors like ABS and CMBS. These assets have observable cash flows and low volatility, but because they aren't in the big, easy-to-trade indices, they offer much higher spreads.
So instead of playing the big leagues, we're all just moving into the high-stakes world of container leasing and shipping logistics.
It's a search for alpha through liquidity mismatches. You can capture a yield advantage by moving into sectors where the lack of frequent trading creates a more stable valuation profile. But there is a massive systemic risk lurking in the background, the expansion of the levered ETF market, which is now over $250 billion globally. Alexander Altman has highlighted that the mechanical rebalancing of these funds creates a short gamma effect. When the market moves, these funds are forced to sell automatically, which can turn a standard market dip into a full-blown liquidity crisis.
So the very tools meant to provide leverage are actually acting as an automated self-destruct button for market liquidity.
Worth noting, when you combine that with the fact that the Fed is shifting toward a supply-driven policy, moving from reactive operations to steady, predictable purchase of treasury bills to stabilize reserves, the margin for error is shrinking. The Fed is trying to manage the plumbing under Chairman Warsh, focusing on the composition of the balance sheet to mitigate interest expense, but the sheer volume of U.S. debt, now exceeding 25% of global GDP, is forcing a search for buyers beyond traditional central banks.
And that's where the energy piece makes everything so much more volatile.
It's the epicenter.
The 3Q Bloomberg Intelligence Investor Survey shows a massive rotation toward high yield, with a net overweight position of plus 10%. But there's a massive divide between the U.S. and Europe. Mahesh Bimalingam noted that European high yield is looking much more attractive because it has significantly lower exposure to energy-related volatility stemming from Middle East tensions. In the US, the energy sector represents nearly 20% of the high yield index. If there's a geopolitical shock in the Middle East, that entire 20% chunk of the US index becomes a massive source of spread widening.
So if a tanker gets stuck in a strait, the entire US credit market starts a synchronized cardiac arrest.
It certainly could. While some investors, like David Fancourt, are staying underweight because spreads are at 20-year lows, others are finding a break-even cushion. Because they are shortening the duration of their holdings, they need a massive 50 basis point move in a single quarter just to see negative returns. It's a defensive structural adjustment.
It sounds like everyone is just trying to build a thicker wall around their capital before the next wave hits.
And that wave might be closer than the stable indices suggest. We're seeing high dispersion and low correlations, masking extreme volatility within individual sectors. The real danger isn't a broad market crash, but a decoupling where widening spreads no longer represent temporary hiccups, but signal permanent, irreversible structural weakness in specific highly leveraged sectors.
Investors in the US high-yield space need to prepare for a much more aggressive period of supply from the energy and tech sectors.
We need to keep a close eye on the August 15th corporate earnings reports, because that's when the true impact of this higher-for-longer environment will finally show up in the actual numbers.
But the credit markets are only one theater of instability. The real physical choke points are starting to tighten up in the shipping lanes. On one side, we have the illusion of stability, oil prices sitting relatively steady at $77 a barrel. On the other, we have a maritime shadow war that looks like it's one drone strike away from a total blackout. Alex, when it comes to the geopolitical volatility in the Strait of Hormuz, which side are you betting on?
I'm betting on the shadow war because the stability we're seeing is essentially a mathematical mirage. While Brent crude hasn't spiked into the triple digits yet, the underlying energy security is incredibly precarious because the flow of regional oil and gas is currently operating at only 1/3 to 1/2 of pre-war levels.
Managed volatility. That's the phrase I'm hearing a lot lately. It's such a lovely, polished way of saying we are currently in a state of escalating maritime attacks and retaliatory strikes on US bases.
It is, and that management is breaking down. According to Daniel Sternoff and Karen Young, the breakdown of the US-Iran Memorandum of Understanding has fundamentally changed the calculus. We aren't just looking at random skirmishes, we're seeing what they describe as a pattern of calibrated escalation. Iran is essentially trying to transform a peace treaty into a permanent extortion framework by using targeted strikes to force a transition toward a tolling system, basically, a permit-based transit system where they get to dictate the terms of movement through the strait.
So instead of a treaty, we have a subscription service for tankers, where you pay the toll or you don't get to pass.
Stepping back, the strategy is working to an extent. Karen Young argues that Iran has already successfully secured sanctions relief through this course of control. They've shifted their strategic leverage away from their nuclear program, which has been eroded by US and regional actions since 2023, toward the control of the strait. They are essentially using a fight power with power stance to deter the Trump administration.
But the Trump administration is leaning into it, right? I'm seeing reports that the recent US military strikes against Iran might be a signal that the White House is moving away from military restraint.
That's the view from Bloomberg Surveillance. The concern is that the US strategy might be relying more on political chutzpah, which is a polite way of saying personal instinct and bravado, rather than the professional maritime security expertise the Pentagon actually possesses. This creates a massive technical challenge. How do you defend commercial tankers against asymmetric threats like highly agile, low-warning drone and missile swarms that are incredibly difficult to detect before they strike?
And that's where the money starts to move. If you can't protect the tankers, the insurance companies stop playing the game.
And that is the nightmare scenario. Argus Media warns of a total withdrawal scenario. We aren't just talking about insurers raising war risk premiums, we are talking about a situation where they revoke coverage entirely. If the maritime insurance market pulls out, the strait becomes unnavigable regardless of the premium offered. Even if we look at the alternative routes like the Omani route, John Ollett has warned that continued instability is already driving up freight rates and leading to massive demurrage costs.
It's interesting because even the safer lanes aren't exactly a sanctuary. I heard about a Qatar-flagged LNG carrier getting hit recently.
That was a huge signal. It proved that even internationally backed lanes are no longer immune to Iranian retaliation. And for the LNG market, that's much more terrifying than it is for the oil market. Unlike crude, the LNG market lacks large-scale strategic storage to buffer these shocks. We are looking at a high-stakes supply-demand squeeze, as the Columbia Energy Exchange puts it, because you have depleted European storage levels sitting at just 51% at the same time, an anticipated heatwave is driving up Asian electricity demand. If you can't move Qatari cargo safely through the southern Omani route, the price spike could be instantaneous.
So we have a massive gap in our defenses. But surely, if the strait gets choked, we can just turn up the taps elsewhere. I mean, the UAE and Iraq have been expanding capacity.
There is some hope there, but it's complicated. Edward Morris suggests that increased production in the UAE and Iraq might mitigate a total closure, especially since the UAE has recently moved to leave OPEC to pursue more independent, unilateral agility in Asia. But there's a massive knockback effect to consider. Argus Media points out that the very infrastructure needed to expand production, like the Jafurah field, is at risk. The need to repair infrastructure damaged by drone strikes could delay these planned expansions for several years.
And let's not forget the elephant in the room or the oil tanker in the strait. Global oil stocks are at record lows. There is zero cushion.
That's the most dangerous part of the illusion of stability that Bloomberg analysts are flagging. Because we have such depleted global inventories, there is no buffer to absorb a sustained closure. We are seeing a war risk premium being baked directly into oil trading right now. It's not just about supply scarcity, it's about the fear of a sudden, unmanageable disruption.
It feels like the market is trying to price in a catastrophe while pretending everything is fine.
And that's why the volatility is so deceptive. Even if supply scarcity isn't the primary driver, as Argus Media notes, demand destruction from the conflict is actually a more powerful price driver, evidenced by the Far East Index dropping 40% from its peak, the structural risk is climbing. We are seeing a shift where the age of drones is moving the risk premium from just the oil supply to the entire refining and logistics chain.
It's a game of chicken where the stakes are global inflation and energy shortages.
The U.S. strategy might be kicking the can down the road, avoiding immediate escalation but leaving the long-term security of the strait completely unresolved. We might just be deferring a much larger, much more expensive crisis to a future administration.
Energy traders need to start looking at the feasibility of the Omani route as a permanent fixture rather than a temporary detour. Keep a close eye on the next round of maritime insurance renewals in the Persian Gulf. If the coverage levels drop, the illusion of stability is officially dead. But as we look at these massive, fragile energy networks, it makes you wonder how much more strain the grid can take from the massive power hunger of the new era of artificial intelligence. 34%. That is the slice of all global climate tech funding in the first half of 2026 that can be traced back to just two massive deals centered entirely on low-carbon data centers.
It's a staggering figure, Maya, and it highlights the core theme of today's session. The energy transition is no longer just about decarbonization. It is being fundamentally re-anchored by the massive, insatiable electricity demand of the AI compute race.
We aren't just talking about a little extra load on the grid. We're talking about a structural reconfiguration of how we value power.
It's a telling detail. We are seeing a shift from a virtual energy economy, where companies just bought renewable energy credits or PPAs to claim greenness, to a physical power endowment model. Developers are now operating under a power-first paradigm, where the hierarchy of needs for a hyperscaler has shifted from processing speed to raw power availability. This means developers are moving away from being mere energy buyers and are instead becoming integrated infrastructure players, acquiring land, permits, and even the generation capabilities themselves to ensure they have 24/7 delivery.
I love that. Power first. It sounds less like a tech strategy and more like a land grab in the Wild West.
In many ways, it is. And it's creating a massive super cycle that, as Damson Moyo has noted, could define the next 40 years of global economics, much like the post-1989 era of globalization. But this isn't happening uniformly. There is a widening divergence in how this plays out geographically. The U.S. has a massive advantage right now because our domestic energy costs remain significantly lower than those in the U.K. or China. We're even seeing massive capital inflows from Australian and European sovereign wealth funds, funds that raised roughly $200 billion in 2025, moving into U.S. infrastructure like power, water, and waste as a defensive hedge against tech volatility.
The picks and shovels of the AI gold rush aren't just semiconductors, they are literally the sewers and the substations.
There's a signal here on Bloomberg surveillance. Analysts recently pointed out that the real alpha in infrastructure investing has shifted from high-profile digital assets toward these neglected, boring essential services. We are seeing a tenfold increase in deal counts for things like wastewater and sewer system modernizations, simply because decades of underinvestment have made them the necessary bottleneck for any new development.
It's a very polite way of saying we're pouring billions into fixing pipes that were already leaking.
It's an essential upgrade because the data center itself is changing the physics of the grid. It's not just about the total amount of energy, it's about the load factor. Data centers require 24/7 intensive cooling, which fundamentally alters the nocturnal demand profile. In traditional markets, we see a typical nighttime demand trough where prices drop. Data centers prevent those troughs from happening. This is particularly dangerous during heat waves. In Europe, we are seeing a transition from a single-season stress model to what is being called a dual peaking market. We used to worry about the Dunkelflaute, the winter periods of low wind and darkness, but now we are facing a Hitzeflaute, or a summer equivalent where high heat and low wind coincide.
And I assume that's where the math starts to break.
It does.
The Hitzeflaute creates a lethal convergence. Heat waves drive up cooling demand precisely when thermal generation, like the French nuclear fleet, is forced offline because river temperatures are too high to safely discharge cooling water. While the total annual energy lost to these outages in France is statistically small, around 0.2%, the systemic risk is the loss of dispatchable capacity. We lose the exact flexibility needed to manage evening price spikes when solar generation vanishes. This is why the industry is pushing toward advanced battery technologies with 8-hour or even 12-hour durations to bridge that missing hours gap.
If you can't rely on the sun or the wind, you have to build a massive, expensive battery to pretend it's still daytime.
That is the engineering challenge. And as the grid struggles, we are seeing some very creative, if controversial, workarounds.
Take Bloom Energy.
As Doomerg has analyzed, their solid oxide fuel cell technology is seeing a massive surge in interest because there is a multi-year backlog in traditional gas turbines. The industry is essentially being forced into alternative architectures to meet AI-driven demand.
But there's a catch.
A recent Hunterbrook report identifies a structural impossibility in Bloom's growth trajectory, arguing that the volume of specialized scandium required for their fuel cells would eventually exceed total global supply and would inevitably cannibalize the needs of the military defense sector.
The future of AI might depend on whether we can outbid the Pentagon for ceramic minerals. That's a comforting thought for the shareholders.
It's a high-stakes game of resource competition. Even the way capital is allocated is becoming more specialized. In the US, we're seeing a shift away from broad renewable plays toward niche decarbonization, specifically targeting liquid fuel solutions for data center backup generation. There's also an opportunity for data centers to move from being grid burdens to grid assets. If developers agree to behind-the-meter generation or load-shedding arrangements, they could actually fund the very grid upgrades that utilities need to survive.
It's a nice vision, the data center as a benevolent helper to the aging utility. But we also have to acknowledge that the S&P 500 has effectively become an AI semiconductor ETF, as Macro Voices recently observed. This means even if you think you're playing the boring utility or industrial sector, companies like Eaton or Caterpillar, you are actually 0.9 correlated to the AI trade. The entire commodity and energy complex is now inextricably linked to the price of a single H100 chip.
The decoupling is happening everywhere. The AI compute race is decoupling climate tech investment from traditional decarbonization trends, as we saw in the H1 2026 funding data. We are moving from a world of deterministic planning, where we knew when the sun would shine, to a probabilistic model, where we have to manage the grid across all 8,760 hours of the year.
Investors in the utility and heavy industrial sectors need to realize they are now effectively running a tech proxy fund.
And the margin for error in that bet is shrinking as the grid hits its physical limits.
Power developers need to finalize their land and interconnection agreements before the era of virtual energy becomes entirely a thing of the past.
Watch the discharge temperature regulations in Europe. If they trigger a larger-than-expected loss of nuclear dispatchability, the summer price volatility will break the current model of the European power market.
But if the energy supply is this volatile, it makes you wonder how much room there is left for the inflated valuations we're seeing in the broader tech sector. I was looking at my grocery bill this morning, and it's a bit surreal to realize that while we're all debating whether AI will write our emails, the cost of a carton of eggs is being driven by much more primitive market manipulation.
It's a strange dichotomy, Maya. We have this massive divergence happening where AI-related capital expenditure is essentially functioning as a private growth engine for the US, almost entirely decoupled from the broader global economy.
So we're essentially building a shiny silicon-based skyscraper on top of a very shaky old-world foundation.
And the stakes for that foundation are enormous. On Bloomberg Surveillance, analysts noted that this boom faces a fundamental mathematical impossibility. The projected $5 trillion in CapEx through 2030 requires about $3 to $4 trillion in new annual revenue, a growth rate that just doesn't have historical precedent.
That sounds like a recipe for a very expensive hallucination.
It's even more complex in the hardware layer. There's a fear that we're seeing a repeat of the 1990s Cisco vendor financing model, where chip makers essentially lend money to customers just so those customers can buy more chips, creating a loop of artificial demand.
Which brings us to the SaaSpocalypse. If the hardware is a loop, the software sector is currently in a freefall.
The S&P 500 Software and Services Index is already down 21%. Between vibe coding and tools like Claude, there is genuine dread that the innovation layer of software is being hollowed out.
But isn't there a difference between the doodads and the actual plumbing?
Unhedged argues that this is a massive valuation error. While AI can replace a user interface, it can't easily replace the mission-critical data layers or regulatory compliance engines held by companies like Oracle or Salesforce. Those stocks are trading at multiples more typical of struggling banks than high-growth tech.
The SaaSpocalypse might just be a temporary panic over the wallpaper rather than the structural integrity of the building.
But the systemic risk is real. The Bank of England has warned that the extreme concentration of these AI stocks could trigger a 2008-style contagion if those unproven earnings forecasts fail to materialize.
Investors in high-multiple tech names need to look for actual ROI before the bubble pops. Keep a close eye on the next round of hyperscaler earnings reports to see if that massive capex is actually translating into any usable revenue. But if the digital economy is this volatile, does that mean we need to look toward more tangible assets, like the massive surge in American oil and gas production? We're looking at a U.S. energy sector that is essentially trying to outrun its own geology. We've got the Trump administration slashing lease rates from 16.67% down to 12.5%, yet the industry is seemingly stuck in a massive integration loop rather than a buying spree.
It's a period of digestion, Maya. Following the trillion-dollar megadeal era of 2022 and 2023, companies like Devon are focused on integrating massive acquisitions, like their $58 billion takeover of Cotra, rather than hunting for new targets. As Ashok Dutta noted, the primary barrier to M&A right now isn't antitrust scrutiny, since U.S. production remains too fragmented for monopolies, but a widening valuation gap between producer asks and buyer bids, exacerbated by the exhaustion of top-tier assets.
The gold rush is over because we've already picked all the best rocks.
The implication runs deeper. The rocks that are left are changing chemically. Structural shift in the Permian Basin's reservoir behavior is driving higher gas-to-oil ratios, which, as oil markets reported, is fundamentally reorienting M&A focus toward natural gas and LNG assets to manage those rising volumes of associated gas.
So if the Permian is getting gassier, the pure oil players are just going to pack up and leave.
They are already looking elsewhere. To maintain oil-centric portfolios, producers are pivoting toward West Africa and potentially the Canadian Arctic. They're also leaning into a technological arms race to keep costs down. We're seeing Devon use AI to run over 850 wells autonomously, alongside developments in 5-mile laterals to push drilling and completion costs below $600 per foot.
It's a lot of high-tech maneuvering to offset much more basic headaches. I mean, oil markets flag that the Trump administration's deregulation is being partially neutralized by the Liberty Day tariffs on steel, which drives up the very input costs needed for that drilling.
So here's the picture. It's a tug-of-war between policy-driven incentives and tariff-driven inflation.
Natural gas investors need to start pricing in Permian supply volatility. Watch the 60-month forward curve for any breakout of that stable $65 to $70 band. As we wrap up this edition, the thread connecting everything we've discussed today is the collision between digital ambition and physical reality. We are witnessing a fundamental decoupling where the speculative momentum of the software and AI sectors is running headlong into the rigid, finite constraints of global commodity flows and power grids. The era of viewing energy as a mere overhead cost is dead. It has become the primary bottleneck for the entire technological superstructure.
The pattern is clear. The single most important implication here is for the strategic capital allocators at firms like Bloomberg Intelligence or the massive sovereign wealth funds managing hundreds of billions. Their calculus is shifting from chasing software margins to securing physical throughput. For these players, the mission is no longer just about optimizing portfolios, but about hedging against a world where maritime security in the Strait of Hormuz or the stability of the European grid can instantly invalidate a tech-heavy valuation. The real alpha is no longer in the code, but in the molecules and the megawatts.
It all comes down to whether the infrastructure can keep pace with the intellect. To see if this thesis of a power-first paradigm holds, we need to keep a very close eye on the mid-August corporate earnings cycle. Specifically, we are looking for whether the massive capital expenditures we're seeing in the AI space actually begin to translate into tangible revenue, or if we are simply watching a massive, energy-intensive build-out that lacks a sustainable economic engine.
If those earnings reports show the hardware is outstripping the utility, the cracks in the foundation will become impossible to ignore.
That is the signal that will define the rest of the year. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.